Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are heading outdoors. But before we actually get into the woods, into the tree stands and the blinds, I want you to picture a scene. It's distinct. It's 4th of July weekend.
Or maybe Labor Day.
Yeah, Labor Day barbecue. You know, the drill friends, family, burgers charring on the grill, condensation on a cold drink in your hand. Everyone is relaxed.
It's the classic American summer tableau.
Exactly. But amidst all that celebration, the conversation shifts. And if you know any hunters, you know exactly what I'm talking about. The talk turns away from the summer heat and toward the fall, to the woods, to the hit list of which deer are showing up on the trail cameras.
It is a timeless tradition. For a lot of people, the planning, the anticipation, the strategy, I mean, it's almost as important as the hunt itself. Yeah. It consumes them months in advance.
It feels totally traditional. It feels like something our grandfathers did on a porch somewhere. But according to the research we're unpacking today, underneath that nostalgic scene of planning the hunt, the ground has completely shifted. Cool. We tend to think of hunting as just, you know, walking into the woods. Nature is free, right?
Right. It's there for the taking.
But there is a massive, complex economic and legal structure that now governs who gets to walk where.
That's right. We aren't just talking about biology or tracking skills today. We are looking at a deep dive into the state of leasing in America. We're pulling data and analysis specifically from the American Hunting Lease Association, or AHLA.
And the mission for this deep dive is to trace a pretty specific evolution. How did access to land go from a simple handshake on a neighbor's porch to a billion-dollar industry? Because that is a massive leap.
It is a fascinating evolution because it really mirrors the changes in the American economy itself. We're going to analyze the shift from asking permission, which is all social capital, to paying for exclusive rights, which is, you know, financial capital.
And why this trend, which actually started way down south, eventually conquered the Midwest and fundamentally changed the sport forever. So let's unpack this, because I think for a lot of people, especially if they grew up in certain parts of the country, the idea of leasing land to hunt might sound a bit, I don't know, corporate, a bit transactional.
A little cold.
Yeah. Like, are we gentrifying the woods? But you're telling me this isn't actually new?
Not at all. That's a common misconception. If we want to understand where we are today, we have to look at the history. And that takes us to a tale of two very different regions. We have to start in the South.
Where in the South?
Specifically Texas, back in the 1930s.
The 1930s. So this has been going on for nearly a century. That predates most of the gear we use today.
It does. In Texas, large landowners and ranchers realized something simple but revolutionary. Hunters and trappers were willing to pay a fee for access. It was a simple supply and demand equation.
And this model spread across the South and Southeast, mostly because of the geography, right?
The geography was key. The South is unique because it features these massive tracts of land. We're talking hundreds of thousands of acres of uninterrupted forest land.
It's not like the patchwork quilt you see elsewhere.
Not at all. And often, those massive tracts were controlled by single entities. Mm. Maybe it was a big timber company or a paper corporation. So for a hunter, leasing was geographically simple. You write one check to the timber company, and you get access to thousands of acres.
The source mentions that private hunt clubs became the standard down there. You'd have clubs with hundreds of members leasing giant swaths of land.
Yeah, it sounds almost like a country club, but with camo instead of golf polos.
Right.
And in a way, it was. It became a way of life. In the South, if you weren't paying to lease ground or joining a club, you essentially weren't hunting. That was just the norm.
So it wasn't seen as elitist.
No, it was just the mechanism of access. If you wanted to hunt, you paid the club dues. Simple as that.
Okay, so that's the Southern model.
Yeah.
Big timber, big leases, big clubs. It's established. But I grew up hearing stories about the Midwest, the Heartland, and that sounds like a completely different vibe.
Oh, completely.
When I think of hunting in Illinois, Iowa, or Kansas, I don't think of massive timber corporations. I think of farms.
No, it was a completely different world. And this is where the story gets really interesting because the Midwest resisted this commercial model for a long, long time. It was culturally allergic to it.
Why the resistance? I mean, if the economics worked in Texas, why not Iowa? Money is money, right?
You would think so. But it comes down to the structure of the land and, honestly, the psychology of the landowner. The Midwest wasn't built on corporate timber tracts. It was built on the family farm.
Right. We're talking smaller pieces of land here. The source says typically what, 20 to 200 acres, grid squares?
Correct. And think about the psychology there. On a 200-acre family farm, there is a deep personal attachment between the landowner and the land.
Sure.
That farmer knows every fence post, every creek bed, every tree. They were historically very hesitant to let strangers in, regardless of the money.
So the handshake agreement reigns supreme there.
For decades, farmers were only comfortable allowing family and close friends to hunt. It was personal. You didn't lease out your backyard to a stranger. You let your nephew hunt the back 40.
Or maybe a neighbor you'd known for 30 years who helped you fix a tractor once.
Exactly. It was a favor economy.
So what changed? Because clearly leasing is huge in the Midwest now. If you go on any forum, people are talking about their leases in Ohio or Kansas. It's huge business.
It is.
What broke down that resistance?
We have to fast forward to the late 1990s. This was the catalyst moment. The structure of the Midwest began to change fundamentally.
The source calls this the moment the bond between landowner and land began to fade. That's a pretty heavy observation. It sounds almost tragic.
It is heavy, but it reflects the economic reality of the time. Small family farms started getting bought up.
By who?
They were purchased by larger farming operations that were consolidating land, or by investment firms, or they were simply swallowed up by urban sprawl.
So the personal connection was getting diluted. It wasn't old man Smith farming the same plot his grandfather farmed anymore. Might be an LLC or a conglomerate.
Exactly. And at the same time, the landowners who were left, whether they were corporations or expanding family farms,
Yeah.
started facing a specific set of headaches regarding the public.
I loved this list of grievances in the source. It really paints a picture. It wasn't just about money, it was about bad behavior.
It's the tragedy of the commons in a nutshell.
It seems like the handshake stopped working because people stopped respecting the hand that shook them. Landowners were dealing with trespassing, littering, gates left open,
Overharvesting of game.
and the unlimited guests problem.
Yeah.
I can imagine a farmer giving one guy permission, thinking it'll be just him, and suddenly three pickup
Oh,
trucks.
yeah, these are my cousins.
Lump of people show up on Saturday morning.
Precisely. It became unmanageable. If you aren't charging for it and you don't have a contract, you have very little leverage to control behavior. Plus, you have to factor in the macroeconomics.
Rising operation costs, unstable grain prices.
Landowners needed a solution. They needed to monetize the land to keep the operation afloat, and they needed to control who was on the property.
And on the flip side of this equation, you have the hunters. And this is where it gets really interesting to me because the Midwest has something the South doesn't always have.
The product.
The product. The Midwest boasts big-bodied and heavy-antlered bucks.
That is the driver. Even on those smaller timber tracts, those 40 or 80-acre pieces, the Midwest has deep wooded draws and basically an endless food supply of corn and soybeans. It allows deer to grow to full maturity.
So you have a deer population that is unmatched, world class, really, and hunters who are desperate to get access to it.
And you have landowners who are tired of trespassers and need some extra
It
cash.
was the perfect storm. The supply and demand finally met. But here is the thing. The Midwest needed a catalyst to bring these two groups together. You can't just put a sign in the yard.
Right, and that's when the industry started to professionalize.
The source uses a great analogy here that I want to unpack. They compare modern hunting lease companies to car dealerships.
It's a very apt comparison. Before this shift, finding land in the Midwest was like trying to buy a car by walking around neighborhoods, knocking on doors, and asking people if they wanted to sell the vehicle in their driveway.
Inefficient, awkward, lots of rejection.
A lot of get off my porch.
Yeah.
Very. But the lease companies came in and acted like dealerships. They did the legwork. They went out and secured the inventory, the land. They vetted the landowners. They marketed the properties on websites. They handled the paperwork.
That's the game changer, right? The internet.
Yeah.
Suddenly, a guy in Florida can look for a lease in Ohio, filter by county, look at aerial maps, and secure a spot without having to knock on a single door.
It turned the lease into a problem solver for both sides. For the landowner, it wasn't just about the money, it was about control. The modern lease involves formal written agreements. This isn't a handshake anymore.
And insurance. That seems to be a huge selling point in the source material. Hunting lease liability policies. It sounds dry, but in this context, it seems critical.
It is massive. If you're a landowner, the fear of someone getting hurt on your property and suing you is real. That's a nightmare scenario, losing the farm because a hunter fell out of the tree.
Of course.
These lease agreements usually come with insurance policies that protect the landowner. It professionalized the relationship. It went from a favor to a business transaction.
And even for the DIY hunters, the ones who still want to approach a landowner directly standing on the front porch, as the source puts it, the expectation has changed.
Right. You don't just shake hands anymore.
You bring a contract and proof of insurance.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It legitimized the presence of the hunter on the land. It signals to the landowner, I am a professional. I take this seriously. I am not a liability to you.
Okay, so we've established that this is a business now. It's an industry. And whenever something becomes a business, there's usually a backlash. And the source addresses this head on, the rich man myth.
This is the most common criticism you hear. Go to any bar where hunters hang out and you'll hear it. The idea that leasing is ruining hunting because it prices out the average Joe.
The perception is that it's only for doctors, lawyers, and executives.
Right. I can't afford a lease, so I can't hunt. It feels like the gentrification of the woods.
But the analysis in the source material pushes back on this pretty hard.
They do. They argue that leasing actually allows blue-collar Americans to manage prime real estate as if they owned it. And they use the math to prove it.
The math is fascinating here. They point out that in most cases, the cost of a year-long exclusive lease is actually less than the annual property taxes on that same land.
That's the key comparison. Imagine trying to buy a 200-acre farm in Illinois.
Yeah.
You're talking millions of dollars in purchase price plus thousands in taxes every single year.
Right.
A lease allows you to have ownership rights for the hunting season, exclusive access, management of the herd, putting up gates for a tiny fraction of the cost of ownership.
So it's essentially renting the lifestyle of a landowner without the mortgage or the tractor maintenance.
Precisely. It democratizes the management aspect of hunting, even if there is a price tag attached.
There's another comparison the source makes regarding the cost that really blew my mind. The comparison between a lease and a guided hunt. Because I think a lot of people see a $2,000 or $3,000 lease price tag in bulk.
Right. But look at how hunters spend money. Many hunters save up all year to go on one big trip, maybe a five-day hunt with an outfitter in Kansas or Pike County, Illinois. That trip alone can cost $3,000, $4,000, $5,000.
And the source points out many of those guides are just leasing the ground themselves.
Exactly. So the argument is, why pay for 5 days of access where you are on someone else's schedule when, for the same price or less, you could lease your own farm for 365 days?
That's a huge shift in perspective. With a guide, you show up, you sit where they tell you, and you leave with a lease.
With a lease, you scout. You hang your own stands. You plant food quads. You check cameras. You manage the land. You get the full experience of being a hunter manager, not just a shooter.
You get to build a relationship with that piece of ground over months, not days.
Right. It's reprioritizing the budget. It's not that hunters aren't spending money. It's how they spend it.
The numbers back this up. The source cites a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service study from 2011. And keep in mind, these numbers are likely significantly higher now.
Sure.
But back then, 1.27 million hunters spent over $1 billion to lease more than 420 million acres.
420 million acres. Let's just pause on that. That is a staggering amount of land.
It's bigger than the state of Alaska.
It is. Mm. And the total sports spending was over $34 billion. So the money is there. The paradigm shift wasn't convincing hunters to open their wallets. They were already doing that on gear, gas, fancy bows, and tags.
The shift was moving access to the top of the budget. So instead of buying the newest $1,200 carbon fiber bow and taking it to overcrowded public land where you might get walked in on, maybe you keep your old bow and spend that money on a lease where you're the only one in the woods.
That's the trade-off many are making. They're realizing that access to safe, enjoyable ground is the most critical piece of gear they can buy. It doesn't matter how good your bow is if there are no deer or too many people scaring them away.
So where does that leave us today? What is the current state of this hidden economy?
Well, the expert deduction from the source is that today, likely more than half of all U.S. hunters pay for access in some form, whether that's a lease, a club membership, or a daily fee. It is the new normal.
But with that popularity comes scrutiny, right? The source mentioned some regulatory battles.
Yes, it's growing pains. The American Hunting Lease Association has had to step in because some states have started to question the legality of these arrangements.
How so?
Specifically, whether lease brokers need to be licensed real estate agents.
Which makes sense. If you're brokering land deals, even if it's just for access, the state wants its cut or wants to regulate it to ensure consumer protection.
Exactly. But the AHLA argues that these are specialized agreements regarding recreational rights, not the transfer of land titles. You aren't buying the dirt, you're buying the right to be on it.
A right to use, not to own.
Exactly. And ultimately, they argue that formalizing these relationships is better for everyone. It reduces conflict.
There's a philosophical point the source makes at the end that I think is really important to land on. We've talked about money, contracts, and insurance, but they emphasize that a lease doesn't guarantee a kill.
No, and that's a vital distinction. You are paying for the opportunity, not the result. A lease doesn't guarantee a booner, a giant trophy buck, or a limit of ducks on the pond. It's not a vending machine.
Nature is still wild.
Right. It guarantees the beauty of the great outdoors and safety.
That's it.
That's it. It guarantees that when you show up at 5 a.m., there isn't someone else sitting in your tree stand. It guarantees that you know who is on the property. It buys peace of mind as much as it buys access. It buys you the solitude that many people are looking for when they go into the woods in the first place.
So let's wrap this up. We've traced a pretty wild arc here. We've gone from the giant ranch leases of 1930s Texas through the resistance of the Midwestern family farm, and finally to this modernized, internet-driven car dealership model of today.
It's a total transformation of the landscape. We've moved from a culture of informal favors to a structured economy. And while some might mourn the loss of the handshake days, and I get that nostalgia, it was a simpler time.
Of course.
The reality is that formalizing these relationships through written agreements and insurance has likely saved private land hunting.
How so? That's a big claim.
It stabilized the relationship between landowners and hunters when it was at risk of falling apart due to trespassing and liability issues. If the only options were let strangers on for free and risk a lawsuit or shut the gates, most landowners would shut the gates.
Leasing provided a third option.
It gave landowners a reason to keep the habitat and keep the gates unlocked, provided you have the key.
It kept the gates open even if there's a toll booth now.
Exactly.
Here's a thought I want to leave you with, and it's something to mull over. We talked about how the bond between the landowner and the land faded, which created this industry. But think about the hunter. If a hunter pays for a lease, works the land, plants food plots, and manages the herd, does the hunting lease actually restore a form of stewardship? Does it give the hunter a sense of ownership and responsibility they wouldn't otherwise have? Or does putting a price tag on every acre permanently commodify nature, turning the woods into just another product on the shelf?
That is the $1 billion question.
Thanks for listening to this deep dive. We'll see you next time.